Welcome to episode 328 of Cinematary. I'm your host, Zach Dennis, and I'm here with
Michael O'Malley,
Nathan Smith.
And in today's episode, we'll be talking about movies that we saw this week in part one. And in part two, we'll be kicking off our world animation series with 1961/1964's The Monkey King. Or, hold on, we got like three names for it. The Monkey King, or Havoc in Heaven, or Uproar in Heaven. One of, you know, it's all the same thing. But first, before we get into the movies that we saw this week, I do want to direct you all to cinematary.com. And I'm a little biased because, you know, it is our website. But I think we got one of the better rundowns, you know, breakdowns of Hillbilly Elegy, the new Ron Howard Netflix film. We have Cam Watson and Ash Baker, both Appalachian natives, talking about the book and the film and kind of in the representation of the characters and the region in this kind of back and forth dialogue review. I think it's worthwhile if you like the movie or if you don't like the movie. I think it's kind of a nice perspective from people who clearly care dearly about this region. So check that out. We also have a review of Martin Rosen's The Plague Dogs from 1982 by Seth Troyer. So head over to cinematary.com. We got some good writing up there. But let's go ahead and jump into movies that we saw this week. And somewhere in Knoxville, Andrew is going to be perking up and getting very excited because we're going to talk about something that I guess is not maybe technically a movie, but Nathan's going to make a case for it. So, Nathan, I'm going to kick off with you.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about one of my really like favorite pieces of media that I've encountered in 2020. As you said, Zach, it is not exactly cinema, but it is made by a filmmaker. I think it has a very filmic, essayistic documentary quality to it, and that each episode of this show kind of stands on its own as a short film almost. And the guy who made it started out making short little documentaries and nonfiction subjects, and the sort of premise of the show came out of those films. So I feel comfortable enough talking about it on a cinema podcast because it has some overlap, I think, with film. But that's HBO Max's HBO, whatever you want to call it, the big that home box office entity. Their new show, How To with John Wilson, which is produced by Nathan Fielder and is the first television series created by the Ridgewood, Queens-based filmmaker John Wilson, who has been making these little shorts on Vimeo for like a decade or something now. And basically most of his films, not all of them, but a good number of them, and the show itself take this sort of like basic foundational kind of like tutorial or instructional premise. Obviously the name of the show kind of indicates that, you know, every episode is titled like how to split the check or how to protect your furniture from damage or like how to make small talk, and his short films are similarly like how to walk to Manhattan, how to live with bed bugs, how to clean a cast iron pan. So they start with these sort of very simple premises where this guy is kind of investigating this subject that he's chosen. And this dude basically films everything in his life. Like he just seems to constantly walk around with a video camera. So the show is kind of from the first person perspective usually, and is often and the shorts are not all this way, but many of them are this way. They're like kind of narrated by him in the first person, and he's got this sort of meek, awkward a little bit voice. You know, sometimes he kind of stutters a little bit. He's kind of soft spoken, and it feels both a little bit maybe affected and played up in a kind of Nathan Fielder way, but also still maybe like, you know, you get the sense that if you meet this guy at a party, like he's probably not like a loud character. You know, he kind of maybe hangs around in the back with his video camera. So it's every episode and all of his short films start from that kind of simple premise of like, let's pick this very ordinary or seemingly ordinary subject and kind of do a deep dive into it. But as I said, you know, he's a New York based filmmaker. He lives really just a hop, skip and a jump away from me. He's over in Queens, and all of his work is like very much based in New York, and is very much about the city. It kind of reminds me of another web series turned HBO series, High Maintenance, a little bit, in the way you're just sort of like going on these tangents throughout the city. But what's really interesting about this is just like the sheer amount of footage he captures, just of like people on the street doing weird things, funny signs, you know, I don't, just like strange objects that have been left on the curb. There are a lot of images that are captured where you're not entirely sure, like if it's artificial or not, you know, if this is something that's staged, or maybe if it's something that like kind of happened and then was recreated in a sort of very like Nathan for You kind of Tim and Eric way, where you're sort of questioning some of the bounds of reality a little bit. But at the same time, you also get the feeling that like this guy is really genuine, and that like he is really interested in filming just sort of everyday life, but using it to these very grand philosophical ends. So he'll start with these small subjects, and then by the end of the episode is sort of really somehow unexpectedly profoundly reflecting on just like mortality and human existence. And, you know, being so focused on New York, it's very much about like what it is like to live in an urban place, what it is like to be a citizen of a city, to be, you know, amongst all of these people. You know, a lot of it is about the conflict between like humans and architecture. There's an amazing episode about scaffolding that is just sort of a deep, like Tom Anderson level dive into scaffolding. And just like, you know, you have scaffolding everywhere in New York, and sometimes it stays there for years for no reason, and just nobody knows why it's there, and it just kind of exists, and it's just this like facet for life of life that's taken for granted. And he starts digging at a subject like that and pulls all of these crazy threads out of it. He finds all of these strange characters like, I don't know, he somehow ends up in one episode like going to like MTV Spring Break in Cancun and like hanging out with these like college bros. Another episode, he somehow gets in with these like foreskin restoration and anti-circumcision activists, and or like, you know, he like follows this guy who's like hunting child predators, just kind of like strange things like that. And his short films are all available on Vimeo for free, and you sort of see the threads of this show kind of coming together. But if you're interested in checking out the short films too, in addition to the show, I think the first two I would really direct you to are The Spiritual Life of Wholesale Goods, where he's sort of like investigating companies that manufacture like really cheap disposable wholesale novelty items. And he goes to like a convention with all of these companies that just make like strange objects that just exist and people don't really think about them, but you know, they're all of these people's livelihoods, and all of these people have these kind of philosophies about making these cheap shitty items that are forgotten and disposed of. And the other one that really struck me is called The Road to Magnus Antti, which is about this like perfect game of SimCity that somebody designed, this city called Magnus Antti, which is just like a repeating cluster of high rises, and it doesn't have any roads, and it has like rampant unemployment, and it's not actually like a functional city, but in terms of the game SimCity, it's like a perfect winning game. And he kind of takes that game, that sort of game metaphor as like a kind of an image for New York, and talks about how New York is this city that on the one hand, you know, it has all of these people who live here and are trying to survive, but the city is like constantly turning against them and trying to destroy the people who live there. And you have this like kind of intense conflict between all of these towering buildings and all of these small people. It's just sort of about how, you know, kind of business and commerce increasingly makes New York an inhospitable and unlivable place. So it goes to some dark places and some heavy places, and it's very much about like gentrification and even police brutality. But you've sort of got the kind of this like very cute, like nice guy narrating it. And you've got the like whimsical chiptune SimCity music playing over all this footage of the city. So as somebody who, you know, I live in New York, I love the opportunities it provides for people watching and for seeing strange images all the time. I really love this show. It's also one of the few shows I've seen, or one of the few pieces of media I've seen, that really ends up dealing with COVID effectively. The last episode of How To with John Wilson is like the start of the pandemic, and I feel like the kind of the way the show works in this sort of observational way of just like things happening is very well suited, I think, to capturing the pandemic, because so much was just kind of like happening, you know, on the turn of a dime, and people didn't know what was going on. So I think it's both a show that's like really serious, has a lot to say, but it's also immensely funny, very clever, very punny, amazing editing, really, really smart. I'm just like already craving more. There's only like 5 episodes, and I instantly went and watched his 11 short films. And I just need more John Wilson in my life, because he's a hell of a filmmaker. What a guy. Seems like a very nice guy. I would love to kick it with him.
Well, you know, I don't know. Go wander around the city. You might be around.
Yeah. Honestly, I've probably bumped into him. Never even knew it.
I know that that one's on my list just because of the connection with Nathan Fielder. So
yeah, it's like Nathan for You collided with High Maintenance. You know, it's got a lot of that energy.
I don't know, that's a because I love High Maintenance as well. So that's all right.
With a little bit of here's another one for you. A little bit of Frederick Wiseman too. It's got some of that. Got some real observations, some events, some meetings, some committees. It's pretty great.
Very nice. Okay. All right. Michael, I'm going to toss it over to you. You have a new Netflix release.
Yeah, new-ish. So this is the movie Over the Moon, which came out earlier this year on Netflix after, I guess, like an extremely small like theatrical run. It also showed at like a festival or something. But so this is an animated movie that I was interested in because it is directed by Glenn Keane, who is like, if you know Disney animation, he's kind of legendary within like the past 30 years as a really terrific character animator. So like he did the animation for Ariel in Little Mermaid, for instance, or Aladdin, like the main character Aladdin in Aladdin. So he's like, you know, this titan of animation. So he has directed this movie that is a computer animated film that is basically, as far as production and cast goes, like really a heavy collaboration with like the Chinese film industry as well. And it was actually produced by Pearl Studio, which I believe is a subsidiary of like DreamWorks that's in China. It's about this girl in China and in contemporary China, and her mom dies at the beginning of the movie because, you know, it's like a kid's movie that...
Of course she does.
You know, it's, yeah, like if you're a parent in a kid's movie...
You gotta die.
Watch out, right? She just got this mysterious disease that she just dies of. And there's no explanation. It's just like the exposition. Her mom always told her this legend, which I don't know enough about Chinese culture to know if this is a made-up legend for the movie or like an actual real legend. But basically, this the legend of this moon goddess who like accidentally, or maybe on purpose, it's ambiguous, like took this potion that made her immortal, but also made her trapped on the moon. And for reasons that are just like more like kind of emotionally resonant rather than like logically resonant within the movie, the girl decides that like she's got to go to the moon to like emotionally reconnect with her mother, because her mother always told her this story. So she like builds this rocket ship and goes to the moon. And on the moon is, in fact, this legendary goddess. And she's like a pop star on the moon, which is weird. But the moon is also this really colorful environment with all these, like, you know, kind of zany, like, mythical beast side characters and a cute little rabbit. And then, like, it eventually becomes this weird sort of, like, Moana-esque, like, gotta, like, reconcile the goddess with herself and, you know, learn something about like my past too. And I guess if going in interested in Glenn Keane from his work as an animator, it definitely feels like the work of an animator in the sense of it is extremely interested in visuals and character design and that sort of thing. And not at all interested in narrative. It is like 10 different like premises for a kid's movie, like all jammed into one another. And like the movie is like constantly shifting tones. There are these like musical sequences that seem like they're trying to evoke like 90s Disney movies. And then there's like stuff that definitely feels like it's trying to be like, you know, maybe like How to Train Your Dragon kind of type movie. And it's like a mess narratively. And it honestly isn't that good. But if I'm interested in like the animation, like the vision of Glenn Keane, it's a really actually very beautiful use of computer animated technology. And Glenn Keane was slated to become the director of Tangled way back in the day, and that didn't work out. But the vision he had for Tangled was like, I want this. He like had this vision of CGI as basically like oil paint in motion. Like that's kind of like his how he viewed it. And I feel like he gets pretty close to that here. Like it doesn't look like oil paint, but like it is a movie that like untethers CGI from like any sort of attempt at like realism and instead is interested in like we can create these really interesting textures and really interesting lighting decision like designs that completely break any sort of idea of like reality or photorealism, but also create really cool looking effects. Like we can make a character glow from inside through translucent skin. And it just looks really cool. And it doesn't look realistic at all, but it creates this weird sort of abstract effect. And like, there's a lot of that in the movie. And so it's like interesting on that part. As far as everything else in the movie, it's not that interesting. And at times it's kind of insufferable because like there's just these like yearning sequences of like you're supposed to feel something really hard, but you can't feel anything because the movie's never settled down enough to actually develop these characters and stuff. So profoundly mixed reviews on this movie. But if you're interested in like the animation side of things, pretty interesting. And also, if you're interested in Chinese animation, which I'm now interested in after this movie that we're talking about today, the Monkey King, it's maybe an interesting like bridge to that as well, considering like its collaboration with Chinese cinema.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that we'll probably talk about a connection between Chinese animation and Disney animation in part two, just in terms of its design and stuff. So cool.
Yeah, it is an interesting like experiment that we have this like really iconic American animator who is like very consciously like stepping out of any sort of like, you know, most like, you know, American animation milieu. Like it's like nominally an American animated movie mostly because of his name attached, but the production itself is like really outside of that. And so it's kind of an interesting crossover situation.
Yeah. Nice. Well, Over the Moon, it's on Netflix. Next, I'm going to talk about a film series. Let me just go ahead and clear that up before we get into that discussion. But it's not really, to be honest. It's in a folder in Amazon Prime. It's just different movies. You know, we
yet another stretching the bounds of cinema.
You know, it's fine. As Jordaine, I saw on Twitter, she said, "You guys have way too much time. Like, go take a walk. Who cares?"
And some of them are a little bit shorter like, than movies often. You know.
So the first one, these are all made by Steve McQueen, who is probably best known in America for 12 Years a Slave. He also did he did Hunger and Shame with Michael Fassbender.
Oh God, Shame! One of the worst movies I've ever seen in my fucking life.
I just wanted to bring that up just for Nathan. He also did Widows, which is his most recent one. Which is I need to rewatch. Kind of was a mixed experience when I saw it in theaters. But the first two of these are on Amazon now. I assume by the time this episode runs on Friday, I think the third one comes out. I can't remember what the schedule was. But the first one is called Mangrove, and it tells the true story of the Mangrove Nine, which took place in West London in 1970. The trial that they had against where they were put on trial. Where the police pretty much put, I want to say, I can't remember the specific number. I think it's like nine Jamaican, I think they're all Jamaican born for the most part, London residents on trial for a protest that took place that police said got violent. But as it shows, you know, there is this, it's clearly very, heavily leaning on the system of justice and, you know, the police for you. That's a very clear line that's being delineated between the two. Probably the most well-known actor in this is Letitia Wright, who plays a member of the she plays Althea Jones, who is a member of the Black Panther Party, but most people probably know her as the sister of the late Chadwick Boseman's character Black Panther in that movie. So some irony there. But yeah, so the movie, it's a little over 2 hours. The first hour is a lot of kind of establishing the community. The name Mangrove comes from the restaurant where a lot of these Black activists and Black Panther members and just people in the community would meet at this restaurant called the Mangrove. It served Jamaican food, West Indies food. And it just was kind of this meeting spot for, these West Indies residents who were living in London, and specifically Notting Hill in the late 60s, early 70s. And after in this neighborhood, in the first part of the movie, you have like this kind of like very stereotypically, like almost over the top racist cop who like is clearly targeting this restaurant and the people who are frequenting the restaurant. You see a lot of raids happening. You see people associated with the Mangrove being stopped on the street and beat up or taken, arrested for no reason and kind of beat up in jail and then let go the next morning. And so they keep having this happen for months and months and months. And then finally they decide to put on this this rally where they go and march from around where the Mangrove is to the police station. And once they get there, things start kind of taking a turn. The police become much more violent, and the movie really doesn't show too much of like this is the violence that's happening at the scene. It kind of shows a little bit of it, and then it really like cuts forward almost almost a year ahead, where they were charged with rioting and various different charges against them, but they were dropped by the first judge. But now, like a year or so later, they've been brought back up, and so they're going back into court because they're trying to hit them and put them away for about 10 years for this, you know, this for this protest that happened a year ago. And that's really where the movie does kind of pick up. So the first hour is just all of these events kind of happening. And like I say, it's almost a little, you have this cop who is like explicitly using the N-word and is just like poster child, like on the poster for, I'm just the most white supremacist cop of all time. He kind of has like this like long, this very like long, evil, like British face to him that you're just like, it's almost like they, you know, built him in a factory just to be like this bigot. And so that almost, there's a little bit of, it kind of takes, it's still effective, but it kind of takes a little bit of the wind out of the sails just because it seems almost like Green Book level of like, we're going to examine racism. But then it gets really interesting in the second half of the movie when it gets into the actual trial, because the movie is less interested in a lot of like the quote unquote like big trial moments. You know, it's not, you know, you can't handle the truth, or it's, you know, it's not like Tom Cruise and Jack Nicholson yelling at each other and like that's the big, those are the big moments of the you know, of this trial and of this case. You know, you definitely have some of those, but a lot of the focus on the trial is more about like just the small systematic, like the way that the system is structured and how that structure is going to inhibit them from getting out of this, you know, with a not guilty plea. And so a lot of the energy is less put into them, you know, going, oh, this is why, you know, why are people racist? What is wrong with this? And more, we understand that. Now, how do we take this system that is in place, that is, you know, systematically built up to be against us, and how do we work around that to, you know, work in our favor? Which I found to be kind of interesting, and it was a much more effective way to go about that rather than just kind of leaning on these, you know, those Oscar moments, those moments where when you have Letitia Wright, if she, you know, she was nominated for Best Actress, like you have that scene where she is, you know, talking sternly in the courtroom to the judge and everybody, you know, that's the clip that they show before they announce the award. You know, they really don't have too many of those, and they really do focus on like, here, like this is, you know, this is this part of the system. How do we, you know, work this into our favor? And I find that to be really a much more effective like conversation as a movie, just because at the end of the day, that's what you need to be focused on anyway, is dismantling the system, not, you know, trying to kind of work in its favor. They're trying to take the system and tear it down as much as they can in order to get out of this case. And so, it was much more effective than I thought it was going to be. I thought the kind of leads, Letitia Wright, Sean Parks, and Malachi Kirby, who plays another one of the strong activists in the Notting Hill community, are all really, really, really good. Especially Malachi Kirby and Letitia Wright's, their characters decide not to use a attorney and are defending themselves in both of their scenes where they are doing character witnesses and you know, cross-examining the witnesses at the stand are really effective, and are probably the closest you're going to get to like that good courtroom scene where it's, you know, the person on the stand and they're having to answer questions. So I would recommend it. I think it's it also handles like these you know, a group like the Black Panthers in a way that's much, this is not, you know, I think we had this conversation a while back when we talked about the Black Panthers documentary by Agnes Varda, But this definitely handles like the Black Panthers and their politics and leftist politics in a way that's much more open than something like Forrest Gump, or I'm sure what the trial of Chicago 7 is like as well. So I would recommend Mangrove. I think it's worth checking out. The other one in the Small Axe series that has come out, which I know gained a lot of attention probably a couple months ago when it premiered at the New York Film Festival. But that's Lover's Rock, again, also directed by Steve McQueen. And this one takes place in the early 80s. It gets its name from a style of reggae music that is featured at this party that the main characters go to. So you have this woman named Martha who goes with her friend to this house party. They've just taken over this, not necessarily abandoned, but this West London home.
Well, it's actually, so I can give a little bit of context.
Go for it.
Because this is actually like, so the party that's depicted in the movie is this kind of whole scene of parties in West London specifically, but also actually kind of throughout England through the 70s and 80s, called blues parties, which were these sort of technically illegal after hours parties that would be thrown by Caribbean and Jamaican and West Indian immigrants. And you know, usually featuring, like you see in this movie, dub reggae, and kind of like very, very important and very central to these parties, which were, like, as you see in this movie, you know, usually house parties, you know, usually like these are people's homes which are converted, you know, into a party space, and they charge admission, and they have, you know, food and Red Stripe and other drinks for sale. And so really kind of like sound system culture was really important to these parties, which mm-hmm. is kind of something.
There's a whole scene to open up the film where they're like setting up the sound system.
Yeah, you know, which is something that kind of develops out of Jamaican DJing culture, and sort of the other branch of Jamaican sound system culture, you know, leads to the development of hip hop in New York and the United States. But in the UK, you know, this kind of like dub reggae sound system scene where you have these DJs and these DJ groups, or, you know, with an MC, kind of like very early rappers, with these like huge DIY speaker setups. You know, they have all kinds of boxes, speaker boxes that have been built and connected together. And so eventually, in the UK, the sort of blues party scene really leads to the development of like the British kind of heavy bass style of techno in the 1980s. It starts changing right after kind of the time that this movie is filmed. You know, this movie takes place in like 1980, sort of right after this, that the sound starts to drift more from dub reggae into like acid house and into techno and you know, eventually kind of developing rave and grime music. Anyways, that's sort of a tangent, but I feel like that's sort of, I don't know, that's just one of the reasons why this movie, I feel like, has gotten a lot of acclaim and has been so talked about, is because it just sort of documents this like very specific community and culture and scene that I don't really think, like, the reason I know about this is literally because I read a book like a couple of months ago about the development of British techno, and it talked a lot about the blues party scene. It's not something I really would have known about otherwise, but it's just like such a unique cultural phenomenon and really I think a birthplace for a lot of British music and a lot of dance music and reggae music, you know, came out of there. And I mean, like, on the other side of the spectrum, not just dance music, but, you know, like The Clash had a song called Lover's Rock on London Calling, and like the members of The Clash were like, you know, you don't see it in this movie, but like you do have, like, at some blues parties, you know, you would have the kind of like couple of white kids who were like daring enough to sort of show up and stand in the corner because they were into the music and they were music buffs, or maybe like gearheads interested in the speakers, and like, you know, the members of The Clash were those kids kind of like sneaking into parties at 3 a.m. and stuff, but it's just like such a, I don't know, it's a really interesting time, and I think the movie really channels that.
Yeah, well, you know, just you know, real quickly, I mean, the story itself in the movie is pretty simple. Like I said, you have this woman, Martha, who shows up to the party with her friend. She meets this guy named, I think it's Sebastian. I'm trying to look for his name. It didn't have it. Yeah. She meets this guy there. They kind of hit it off, and it's, you kind of fluctuate between these very small, but like very going to a party storylines. You know, you have like the overbearing, super creepy guy who's just like becoming very touchy on like all these women, and finally like takes one off and like seems to like be beginning to rape her. And of course they're able to stop it before anything really goes too far. You have like, the friends kind of getting mad at each other. You just have like all these small storylines that aren't anything substantial. It's just like, this is what happens when you like just go to a party, especially like, you know, if a party like this, like this is just what happens. And so that's, there was something kind of nice about that. This, you know, I said off mic before, this is very much a vibe movie, because you have like these long extended sequences where they kind of play, you know, Steve McQueen will like play the whole song out to an extent, and you just watch as people kind of, you know, sway with one another and just kind of dance and you know, go along to the beat. There's this one really wonderful sequence where they like turn the lyrics off and everybody is singing the song along with the, you know, with the beats behind it. It's just like this really communal movie, and he really like puts you inside just the whole feel, the whole vibe of the, you know, of the party, and just of how the music is resonating with everybody. But Nathan, I know you've seen this as well. I mean, what did you make of Lover's Rock?
I liked it for the most part. I think I was a little bit more mixed on it than a lot of people. You know, like you said, the vibes are immaculate, and it's really at its best when it's a sort of hangout movie. You know, it reminds me a lot of something like Olivier Assayas's Cold Water, which is a very needle drop driven party movie. You know, a lot of people have compared it to Claire Denis, and I think a lot of the use of music and focus sort of on the movement of bodies to music is very similar. And I love a lot of the music that's in the movie. You know, you've got some great, like, you know, we've been saying, a lot of great reggae and dub, and also a little bit of like disco and kind of just soul music. There's like one of my favorite sequences is like right towards the end when it's like very late at night, and you know, you've had all of this like weed smoking throughout the party, and you know, everybody is just like absolutely out of their minds at this point, but there's this like one instrumental dub track that the DJ drops, and everybody just gets like absolutely buck, and they like make them run it back like two or three times and start the track over, and everybody just loses their minds each time they start the song over, which I think that sequence kind of captures to me, like, that's really like what I really like about Steve McQueen. Honestly, I think my favorite film of his is this Kanye music video that was like that played at like an art gallery in LA and like leaked online but was never officially released, for the song All Day, and also for the song I Feel Like That, which was never released on any Kanye album. But it's just like Kanye running around this room like getting really hyped up, like getting really amped up during All Day, and eventually as the song goes on, it gets like more paranoid and more frenetic, and it feels like at first it feels like he's trying to like demand the camera's attention, and then it feels like he's trying to avoid the camera, and then eventually he just kind of like collapses in the corner. And I think that Steve McQueen is really good at just like capturing the sort of like the, I don't know, just like this like palpable physical energy in a room, which is why he's so good at this kind of like musical movie, and this kind of jukebox driven movie, is just because he's really knows how to make the camera feel kind of in touch and feel like it's in a conversation with the body. Now, what I don't like about Steve McQueen rears its head a little bit in this movie, but is more under control than in some of his other movies, which I think sometimes maybe because he was sort of a gallery video artist first and wasn't like a narrative filmmaker starting out. I think maybe, I don't know, his movies are always trying to maybe like overcompensate for that for me. Like sometimes they just feel like very clunky, like very screenwriterly, like big kind of overdrawn themes. And I just feel like a lot of times when this movie slides back into narrative mode, when it's like, oh, like the two friends who are sort of, one of them's jealous of each other, or like the creepy guy, or this relationship stuff, I feel like the movie gets a lot, like when it gets into those moments, it just feels like very generic. And it also feels like a little stagey and a little theatrical, and like I could be watching a play almost, which is kind of the vibe I get just from some of the other entries in the Smollett anthology. Is it just sort of all seems like they could be like stage plays almost, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but like I don't know, it just sort of, I felt, you know, at one time I would be like really into the dance scenes and the sequences that are really music driven, and then when it becomes dialogue, like character stuff again, I'm just like really uninterested. But every time that would happen, he would kind of win me back with like another song.
I would agree with that assessment, because yeah, like that's why I say like the plot elements of it are pretty, I thought they were gonna honestly be much more substantial than they really were. Like it was kind of described to me as like this, not necessarily like a, you know, like a movie we talked about last week, Certified Copy, or something like Before Sunset, where there's like this kind of romance that goes through the night. But I honestly, like the romance between the two main characters is relatively sidelined for the most part, because yeah, like you just have like the best parts of this movie are these kind of prolonged sequences where they just play out the song, and he's just, like you're describing, like moving through the group of people all dancing and just bodies, you know, bodies touching one another. And it's just like, you just have like this smoky air because everybody's smoking weed. And it's just, it really, like, again, it's just like this deeply communal space. And I think, I know just seeing a lot of comments from people out of the New York Film Festival, like a lot of people were just, I think there was like this nostalgia for parties of that degree, just because of, you know, COVID, the situation that we're in, where you can't, like, you just look at that movie and you're like, oh my God, that's, you know, completely unattainable, and you know, at the moment we're in right now. And there was a little bit of that kind of nostalgia for moments like that. But yeah, I mean, I would agree with that, because the storylines themselves are pretty dry and boring, but then, like you say, like a needle drops and you're like, yeah, I'm back in it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would recommend both of them. Mangrove and Lover's Rock are on Amazon Prime. They're in the little folder that says small acts. And I think the new film with John Boyega playing a cop is coming out soon. So that was the other one I know that's coming up. So we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back talking The Monkey King after this.
Hey, Cemetery listeners, Andrew here. At the midpoint of this week's episode, I want to direct you to some of the non-podcasty things we have to offer. First, if you're a fan of what we do, please consider supporting us on Patreon. For $5 a month, you get three things: a shout out at the end of every episode, the opportunity to choose a movie we cover on the show, and our Patreon exclusive podcast, Film Theory and Chill, in which we look at a piece of theory once a month, deconstruct it, and then just chill out, talking about whatever else we have going on. All Patreon support goes solely to paying our writers for their reviews that go up on our website every Monday. Also, at the bottom of cemetery.com, you can sign up for our free newsletter. Every Sunday, we send out an email with the latest podcast episode, Patreon content, and written reviews. This is perfect for those who want to keep tabs on what's happening, but might be too busy to see the posts when they go up. Before I go, one more quick thing. The easiest thing you can do to support us is to give Cemetery a rating and review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to the show. This is quick, free, easy, and we will read your review out on the show once we get it. To recap, consider donating to our Patreon, sign up for the free newsletter, and please give us a rating and review. Thanks for listening. Let's get back to the show.
we're back with part two of episode 328 of Cinematary. In this part, we'll be kicking off our world animation series with 1961's The Monkey King, again, a.k.a. Havoc in Heaven, a.k.a. Uproar in Heaven. It's directed by Wan Lei Ming, and the story is based on the earliest chapters of the Ming Dynasty Shinmo novel, Journey to the West. The main character of Sun Wukong, a.k.a. the Monkey King, who rebels against the Jade Emperor of Heaven. Wan Guchan of the Wan Brothers and one of the animators of the feature film Princess Iron Fan began planning the production of Havoc in Heaven after Princess's release in 1941. However, the project was delayed for over a decade after the Japanese capture of Shanghai during the Second Sino-Japanese War and later by the Chinese Civil War. Wan Lei Ming returned to Shanghai as director of Shanghai Animation Film Studio in 1954, and production of Havoc in Heaven resumed shortly thereafter. The first part of the film was completed in 1961 by Lei Ming and Guchan, and then the second part was completed in 1964 with the assistance of Wan Kao-chin and Wan Di-huan. Both parts of the film were screened together for the first time in 1965. This was the last major animated film of the second golden era of the cinema of China. A year later, the entire industry was effectively shut down by the Cultural Revolution. The name of the movie became a colloquialism in the Chinese language to describe someone making a mess. And countless cartoon adaptations that followed have reused the same classic story, Journey to the West, yet many consider this iteration to be the most original, fitting, and memorable. Quickly, a little bit of history on the Chinese animation industry. So in 1922, Wan Lei Ming produced the first animation in a cartoon advertisement for Shuzhendong Chinese Typewriter, followed by the 1924 animation short Dog Treat. The Shanghai Tobacco Company also produced an animation called New Year. These are the earliest known cartoon shorts in China. In 1926, the four Wan brothers, who I've mentioned before, they all worked under the Great Wall Film Company in China, not to be confused with the Great Wall Movie Enterprises. Wan Lei Ming and Wan Guchan were then recognized as China's animation pioneers when they produced the first animation short Uproar in the Studio, running 10 to 12 minutes long in black and white. The brothers believed that Chinese animation should be instructive, logical, and thought-provoking besides being entertaining to its audience. They wanted to emphasize the development of an animation style that was uniquely Chinese. It was a common trend at the time to combine live-action film footages with 2D animation. By 1932, one of the Wan brothers, Wan Di-han, would voluntarily leave the Great Wall Film Company for his own photography studio. Some of the first wave of influential American animation that reached Shanghai were Popeye, and a show known as, in pretty much an off-translation show version of Betty Boop. By 1935, the Wan brothers would launch the first animation with sound titled The Camel's Dance. 4 years later, in 1939, America's Snow White would also be introduced in Shanghai, and it would be a great influence. In 1941, China's first animated feature film of notable length, Princess Iron Fan, was released under very difficult conditions during the Second Sino-Japanese War and World War II using extensive rotoscoping. While there were overlapping progress made in the Asian regions with Japanese anime at the time, they were not geographically or artistically influential to China directly. During the Japanese invasion period, the brothers produced more than 20 animated propaganda shorts, focusing on various patriotic topics from resistance against Japanese troops, opium, and imperialism. It can be said that in the short run, the financing of the Shanghai Animation Film Studio was strictly an extension of Mao's anti-rightist movement. Following up on speeches like let hundreds of flowers blossom and hundreds of schools of thought contend, Mao has publicly admitted that promoting new art forms and institutions was vital to the new China, though with time his political campaign would prove to be a major backlash to the industry, putting an end to the golden era. And on that note, let's jump into The Monkey King. I figure we can talk a little bit about kind of where it's at politically later, but I wanted to kind of just start talking about the film on its own, because as Michael and I kind of talked about off mic before we started, it's pretty, at least in terms of like its anime, just like the animation itself, the style, the kind of the way it's drawn, it's pretty, you know, it has like these connections, clear connections with like Disney. You can tell that, you know, they probably saw Snow White and a lot of these early Disney animated films and were influenced by it. But it also kind of takes it to another level. Like there is just this fluidity in a lot of these scenes that I feel like is on a different level from what you were seeing with Disney. So Michael, I'm going to lead it off with you. I mean, what was your impression of The Monkey King?
I mean, I really liked it. And I mean, I think that you said it well with like the animation. Like I was extremely surprised at how like just smooth and elaborate the animation is, especially for like the characters. Because my experience with animation from like the mid century is the short, you know, a lot of times there's these really, you know, ambitious shorts, like in America you have like Chuck Jones and stuff. You know, elsewhere you have like, you know, really ambitious shorts. But when you get into feature length films, you know, it really shows that like, you know, Walt Disney had all that, you know, Snow White money, basically, whereas the rest of the world didn't. And a lot of times I'm used to like really arresting imagery kind of communicated through animation that's like low budget. But this didn't feel like that at all. Like, I mean, it's like incredibly smooth. In a way that I wasn't expecting, and it does like feel like Disney, but in some ways it doesn't. Like the like early like pre World War II Disney, it feels very like painterly and like kind of stately a lot of times. Like, I mean, they have these cute characters, but you know, in something like Pinocchio or Bambi or something like that, you also have just like there's a lot of like just kind of being like enamored with like how elaborate can we make these backgrounds and how like you know, ornate can we make these things, like with this idea that like Walt Disney was kind of like enamored with like high art and stuff when he was making these movies. But this one doesn't seem to be like that at all. And like, it makes sense that like Popeye might've been like a real big influence on it, because there's a cartooniness to it that's really appealing to me. Where, you know, you have these like big mythological characters, like the Jade Emperor and you know, the titular Monkey King. But it's really playful and elastic, like how these characters act, in a way that doesn't feel like something that Walt Disney would have allowed in the features. Maybe in like a Silly Symphony short or something like that, it would have, you know, it kind of has that character, but like just how like stretchy everything is. And that's by like design of the story too. You know, the main character, the monkey, like one of his signature powers is he can change his size all the time. And there's like several objects in the movie that are like constantly changing size. But I also feel like just on a aesthetic level, like this movie is really not committed at all to like any sort of like static reality, you know, that the characters in the movie are constantly like changing shape and changing like size and proportion to each other, even if it's not like their power. Like that's just kind of the aesthetic of the movie, and it feels very stretchy and combined with like the real smoothness of the animation. I think it just sounds really, or not sounds, I think it looks really, really cool. I don't know, what did you guys think?
Yeah, we can go back to at some point we can talk a little bit about especially the fight sequences, because you have these like large battles between the Monkey King and these various mythological figures. That is like the way, there's one in, you know, specifically that happens late in the film where the Monkey King and the character he's fighting like are shape shifting, and it reminded me of a sequence like in Fantasia where there's nothing really like groundbreaking or incredible about it, but like the characters are like moving across this kind of linear path, and they're going behind like these trees, and in the way that they're like kind of shifting how they're facing the camera, but there's like this kind of like very like quick motion to it. And at this sequence in The Monkey King, it's doing kind of the same thing, but it's like shifting in quick motion to, you know, they're a swan or they're a snake, or, you know, it's like, or like a, you know, chipmunk. Like it's really like the way that the animation is able to pivot in a way is just really like, that was really you know, exciting to me. Like that was really engaging with me. Nathan, what did you make of the movie?
You know, it's interesting. It was my first real encounter, I think, with Chinese animation. For as much as I really love Chinese cinema, and I guess I'm kind of sometimes the unofficial cinematary Chinese cinema correspondent. But, you know, I don't know. I think part of it is just there not being like a, you know, tremendously at least available, you know, Chinese animation, kind of, you know, it's not really like, I mean, I don't want to say it's like small necessarily, because I feel like my own knowledge is very limited, but I just feel like at least in terms of distribution, in the United States, it's not something we really see at all. So I was like very surprised, first of all, at like just the quality of the restoration of this. Like, I think the YouTube version that's like 2 hours long is like a fan assemblage of some different cuts. I didn't really know the specific details, but it seemed like it was it took the recent Blu-ray cut that's shorter and added in the scenes that were not in that, like from another copy or something like that. I did notice a little bit of a quality change at certain points. So just that on top of like the already overall very strong quality of the animation, I think was like, it was really impressive, just because I was, you know, Michael, like you were saying, you sort of just generally expecting this to maybe be something kind of lower budget. I was also just expecting that this would not be a movie like in the greatest shape, just because it, again, doesn't seem like there's a huge kind of outspoken like tradition of preserving and making Chinese animation accessible. But to the point of like the quality of the animation, you know, you guys were talking about the fluidity and just like this sort of seamlessness of the motion. And, you know, like I said, I'm not super familiar with a lot of Chinese animation, but I am a little bit familiar with like the Journey to the West story and the kind of Monkey King story through like the more recent Stephen Chow and Choi Hark Journey to the West movies and like the Monkey King blockbuster franchise. And just so you know, that story being referenced a lot in Chinese and Hong Kong cinema. And I was sort of thinking about the movie like just kind of in that context of like Chinese culture and myth and art. And I was really impressed by how this movie, in the sort of style of character movement and the motion, like how, you know, live action Chinese film, both like literal musicals, but also like martial arts films and action films, you know, are so informed by like the tradition of Beijing opera and like the really sort of rigorous like physical dance training that a lot of performers would undergo. You know, if you were working and if you were a Chinese film performer, you had probably had all of this like really intense stage dance, ballet, opera training too. And this movie really, I feel like, tries to kind of replicate that style, that just like very expressive, very fluid, very sometimes like extreme movement where you're just sort of like aghast at what people are doing with their bodies. You know, you feel like a lot of people watching Chinese martial arts film, you sort of experience that just like you're in awe of the performers. And obviously this is a little bit different because it's an animated movie, but I was sort of in awe at like the animators and the people literally drawing the frames for their kind of replication of physical performance. You know, obviously it's like animals and these anthropomorphized fantastical creatures and stuff and not like human beings necessarily. But it's just like in terms of those like extended action set pieces you were talking about, Zach, you know, it's just very fluid, very musical, like in its movement, just really sort of expressive and kind of captivating just in like how good that animation is. You know, sometimes the action scenes run on a little bit too long, but it is like just kind of impressive. I don't know. They're just like, there are these just like such extended scenes without much dialogue, just sort of set to music of pure movement. It's kind of crazy a little bit.
I really dug the music too. Like, this movie is basically like wall to wall, like traditional Chinese music. And I thought that was just like a really, really cool element of the movie. And I mentioned this in my Letterboxd review, but I feel like, at least in the films that I'm familiar with, which this was also my first Chinese film, so maybe this is, or Chinese animated film, so maybe this is different in Chinese animation or even Chinese live action, but like it was animated movies, at least in English language cinema, that really pushed forward the use of music and score and made score a lot more dynamic, I think, in American cinema or English language cinema. You know, something like Bambi has a much more dynamic score than like any other like 1940s like American film that I can think of. And this felt like kind of in the same vein, where like the music itself was like an animating force that worked with the actual visuals as well. And I just thought that was super cool.
Yeah, totally. It reminded me of like actually I do remember the phrase that like Powell and Pressburger sort of use like when talking about, I don't know, their sort of philosophy of movement and like Tales of Hoffman, where they sort of wanted like notated kind of punctuated movement, you know, to like have sort of physical movement literally sort of linked up with the musical score. And I feel like this movie has that sort of like very kind of like punctuated quality that you're talking about, with a lot of like the way that it, you know, like, again, the sort of like use of music and Western animation is similar, of just like having the sound and the score really be such an integral part, you know, really defining like what the image is and what the movement is, you know, determining kind of like the motion of characters and sort of I don't know, it sort of comes from the music first almost, because so much of it feels really tied to it.
Yeah, I also feel like, you know, and maybe Nathan, you can speak a little bit more to this, just since you're much more familiar with the folklore, but it seems like it's very, you know, it seems like it's kind of using, you know, folklore to its, you know, best abilities, which is to kind of speak to somewhat of a present moment. I saw a lot of people kind of making connections with this film and, you know, what's happening culturally in China at the time, kind of viewing, you know, the Monkey King character as kind of this Maoist figure with, you know, with the Jade Emperor and kind of these other gods in heaven being, you know, the rest of the world kind of looking down on China or trying to kind of stifle China. And so you have like this character that's very elusive and, you know, a little brash and a little arrogant, but is also trying to do this all in service of, you know, like everything he's doing is because he's just like, yeah, I'm trying to take care of my other little monkeys with me here in the mountain of, was it flowers and fruits? And so, I don't know, did either of you kind of clue in on that, just as like this kind of allegory to the, you know, the kind of cultural political scene, you know, what's happening in China at this time as this movie's being made?
I'm also mostly familiar with Journey to the West through the Stephen Chow movie and a couple other like things that I've seen. And so the thing that struck me about this movie is like, and maybe Nathan, you know more about this than I do, maybe, but the real large arc for the Monkey King in the whole story is that he eventually has to pay for his, like, you know, kind of rebellion against the gods and quote unquote mature, right? Isn't that kind of like he has to help on this the titular journey to the West, right? He has to help on that quest, and that's like kind of how he redeems himself after being, like, you know, this instrument of mayhem in the beginning. But this movie doesn't have that. It just, like, has him win at the end, and then that's the end of the movie. And that, like, really struck me as, seems like, you know, a really, maybe, it seems to me maybe a revisionist take on the whole story. I don't know enough about the tradition of the whole story to know, but, like, it seems significant that we don't get any of the arc of humbling. We simply get the mayhem, and that seems, like, extremely important for a, you know, through, like, a, you know, Marxist Maoist lens, at least.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's very interesting because the Monkey King is, for the most part, in this movie, like you're saying, just this, like, anarchic kind of force. I don't know, in some ways, like, you know, that kind of, like, humbling process, like, you know, seems like more in line with Mao or like what Mao would want to communicate to the people than just, like, you know, change through kind of pure mayhem, and then, like, some new world is established immediately. I feel like, I don't know, that kind of, like some kind of, like, long, arduous process of you know, learning and self-criticism seems, like, very Maoist to me. So it is interesting to point out that that's sort of left out of this rendering of the tale. I don't know. I mean, it's, I don't know if I felt like I really sort of detected a strong kind of political impulse to this movie, but I do think, I don't know, there's maybe something to be thought about in just how, you know, like, post-revolution, just thinking about, like, the kind of construction of a really, like, shared culture and, like, shared history, and sort of, I don't know, the Monkey King as a myth sort of just, like, serving that kind of purpose of like, building national identity. And it's really interesting to see just, like, the change in, like, the Monkey King story over time, and, like, the actual sort of like, production, I guess, of how the story is told, because I feel like with sort of, it's just sort of like the fact of the mediums and the technology, but, like, I feel like hand-drawn, really sort of rigorously designed animation like this almost, like, speaks to the real kind of, like, heyday of Mao and in the early years of the People's Republic. I don't know, it just feels like a very sort of collectively produced medium where you're so aware that it takes a force of people to create this movie together. Whereas, like, the more, even though the Monkey King in this movie is, like, very sort of, like, mayhem, anarchy kind of, you know, live wire character, I do feel like, I don't know, the sort of, like, both the, maybe the Stephen Chow and Choi Hark Journey to the West movies, and but also the Monkey King franchise, which is just, like, the sort of epitome of, like, the big bland Chinese blockbuster now. Like, the other Journey to the West movies are great, but the other Monkey King movies are just kind of, like, the sort of big wooden Chinese CGI special effects spectacle that there's, like, a lot of now. And I don't know, it just sort of, like, you know, there's this sort of, like, it's just, like, a lot of scale and spectacle now in a kind of different way, that feels, like, a little bit more catered for, like, the international global market beyond just China. Whereas this still feels, like, very much like you know, very inwoven into like Chinese national identity. That was that tangent. I don't know. I was going all over the place, but
I agree, because this one, and I think maybe this is why it seems like this is kind of the one that people seem to point to as like the most, the most original, the most like in touch with like the actual story, because I think you're right. Like there is it, you know, it kind of became something that, you know, you look at like a lot of the, I mean, I'll preface by saying these are vastly different, you know, pieces of work, but you look at like something like, you know, a lot of our big properties today, like whether it's superhero property or even like kind of something where they're bringing back like something that was popular like in the 80s or the 90s and are like trying to you know, like the Terminator movies, where it's like so far gone from like what appealed to audiences when that movie first came out, because they've just been trying to kind of reimagine and like reignite it for an audience. And so like the Monkey King Journey to the West movies now are just so like they're trying to appeal to like this mass international audience that it's kind of stripped of its Chinese identity. And like this one seems very pure. Like that's why I say like the folklore of it is really appealing to me, because it just feels very ingrained in, you know, that mythology. Like I don't know. Again, I haven't read Journey to the West, so I'm not familiar with the text, but it just seems like it's very like just the story beats and kind of the personalities and paths that it takes feels very much like you're reading some sort of, you know, storybook retelling of this tale.
You've got like narratively like a real kind of folklorish feel of like the episodicness of it. So you have like the overarching conflict of like this Monkey King is he's causing a lot of trouble. You know, he's declaring himself the most wisest sage or whatever he does. But then you get these little incidents where like the like hosts of heaven, or you know, whatever we call like the divine beings, where they do little different things to try to deal with him that feels very like folklore-ish, you know, where it's like, well, first we're going to trick him into taking care of these horses. And, oh, now we're going to try to trick him into being in this like peach garden where the peaches only come once every like 10,000 years. And like, that feels like, it does feel like kind of unadulterated, like, folk storytelling that's not trying to like fit into like any sort of like screenwriting convention or anything like that. It just feels like how a folk story is told. And I think that that's like a really impressive part of the commitment to like, you know, whatever we're calling like the, you know, the cultural integrity of this object, is that it allows it to just be this kind of weird, like folklorish thing rather than to try to narratively like modernize it or make it, at least from the Western perspective. I don't know nearly enough about the history of Chinese cinema as a whole to know like what their screenwriting conventions are. But like, I know that like, you know, we had that spate of like a couple, I guess it was like 10 years ago, where everyone was wanting to do the fairy tale adaptations. And like, they all like kind of did the same thing where they tried to, you know, make some sort of conventional emotional arc to the characters, and that really doesn't exactly work with fairy tales all the time, because fairy tales are kind of conceived under this like kind of folklore logic, you know, where and it's always fun to see movies like actually stick with that kind of logic rather than try to make movie logic out of it. And I guess that's kind of the vibe I got narratively from this movie too.
Yeah, that's I think a really good way of putting it, because I feel like this movie has sort of like that energy that a lot of the original Disney movies have, where, you know, they may be a lot more smooth around the edges in terms of the content of the story compared to like the original Grimm fairy tales or whatever. But they have become like sort of synonymous just with like archetypal fairy tales in American culture, really. And this just like the sort of the style of the animation and everything about it has that same kind of like same sort of energy to me, where this feels really linked just kind of like with the original folklore. And it feels very much just like it's still in that kind of fairy tale mode. Whereas, the more recent versions of the Journey to the West stories feel basically like superhero movies, which I think the sort of fairy tale live action remakes and all that, a lot of those movies are, you know, obviously they're Disney movies, both Marvel and the fairy tale stuff, for the most part. But I feel like a lot of those movies are kind of modeled, like, in terms of the narrative structure that they try to give to fairy tales. They have a lot in common with superhero movies. And I don't know, that just feels like kind of the change, too. And I feel like, I don't know, I feel like sort of Chinese, like, folklore just lends itself really well to this kind of animation, because you have so much like anthropomorphization and, you know, so many different kinds of creatures and, you know, morphing of bodies and all of that. And like, you know, you have some great special effects in like the Stephen Chow Journey to the West. But it is a sort of hybrid style. So it's really cool to see them go all the way. You know, it's sort of like the difference between like, the Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings and the Ralph Bakshi Lord of the Rings. Like, I feel like the hand, you know, the hand drawn animation is able to channel a like a sort of more magical energy, almost.
Any final thoughts on The Monkey King before we wrap up?
I mean, it's really good. I mean, is this all of our first like Chinese animated feature?
Yeah, I've been for a few years been wanting to check out the Chinese Ghost Story series. Produced by Choi Hark, which like, I don't know, all I really know about Chinese animation is, I guess, through more like the development of like special effects in Chinese film, which is really interesting, which is feels kind of adjacent. But I, you know, I'm very interested to like see more, because I feel like there's gotta be a lot of like more interesting sort of folklore centric stuff like this, I imagine.
Yeah, because this is like, this whole series is like international animation, and like, I think one of the interesting things about it is like animation is so dominated by Japan and the United States, and I think that that kind of like defines what a lot of people think about animation. But a lot of different countries have their own like national animation cinemas that a lot of times haven't really made very much of a mark on like Western English speaking, like the Western English speaking world. Like, you know, we'll get into like the Soviet Union, I guess, next week. And then China, like those are like throughout like the middle and later 20th century, like those are like internationally, like the huge, you know, they're huge industries, in a lot of ways that sort of rival like, you know, what we're familiar with in the West. And I didn't know anything about, you know, Chinese animation before this movie. And I guess without having seen any other Chinese animated films, I'm going to say that this is maybe a good entry point. I mean, I certainly enjoyed it, at least. I don't know how representative it is of the larger industry, but like it feels like a really vital and interesting, and unique without feeling like completely alienating, and difficult or inaccessible way to like enter like, you know, this other like national animation cinema, at least to me.
No, I agree. I agree. And it's a little lengthy, cause it's the two parts kind of put together. It's 2 hours, which is just a little long for, you know, a movie kind of like this. So I guess you could technically watch it in two sittings. It's like part one and part two. But no, I would agree. This is a perfect, if you're interested in exploring Chinese animation, this seems like a nice entry point.
I was just going to really quickly, piggybacking off sort of what you were saying, Michael, just like, I think that, animation is like a really interesting way of sort of engaging with like other cultures and national cinemas, just because, I mean, obviously it's like in some ways a little bit to the detriment of animation, a little bit sad that it is so often linked with like children's cinema. But at the same time, I think it also makes it like really interesting as sort of just like a cultural artifact or document, because I don't know, when people are making work for children, you know, they sort of think like, okay, what are like the like foundational stories of our shared culture, or like, you know, what are like classic stories that like everyone knows or needs to know. So I feel like through animation, since that's again so often linked with like the first stories that children are being told or exposed to, you really get like a sense of, you know, of folklore or of cultural history, or like, or I don't know, you know, whatever a kind of ideal national identity is, you know, I feel like there's a lot of rich stuff to dig into. So I don't know. I think that's one of the like interesting things about looking at animation outside of those epicenters.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that that's a good point to kind of think about for everybody as we kind of go into this series, because like Michael said, you know, predominantly when we're talking about animation, we're talking about, especially in the United States, we're talking about Disney animation. And there's, you know, there's places to break off from there, but that's the kind of dominating force in you know, American animation. And then in Japan, you know, anime is just such a force on its own that it kind of has its own oeuvre, its own world all to itself as well. And so I think I agree, like animation, and especially animation like this, where it's built in this kind of folklore setting where it's really taking down the bare bones of like, how are we going to tell this cultural story in the most succinct way? Is not only a great way, you know, this is not only like an entertaining movie, but it also is a way to kind of engage with how, you know, Chinese culture is taking part in storytelling and kind of like a way to kind of better understand, you know, how they're creating their own myths and things of that nature compared to what we're doing. So it's a nice little education as well. Which I guess is the point, because they said that they wanted, what was it? They said that they wanted it to be instructive, logical, and thought-provoking, besides being entertaining to its audience. So, good on you.
I will say, like, two of those three, it hits. I'm not sure about the logical part.
Like, what are you talking about? It's very logical. I mean, he puts the big sword thing in his, or the big stick thing in his ear. I was telling Michael off mic, this is just a nice fun anecdote. I watched the Zha Zhengke movie Unknown Pleasures this week, and there's a scene where these two characters are hanging out in just like this room and they're watching TV, and the Monkey King, this Monkey King movie is on the TV, and the one character is like in school or whatever, and she's talking about this takes place like in the late 90s. And how she, like, sharing her feelings about China in the World Trade Organization and all, you know, kind of like the political scene at the time in China. And the main character of the movie like has this nice throwaway line when he's like staring at the movie and is like, I want to be like the Monkey King. The Monkey King does not have to worry about the WTO. All right. Well, that will wrap up this episode of Cinematary. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematary, on Twitter and Instagram @cinematary, and on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/cinematary, where we have all the movies listed that we talked about in this episode. Head over to Patreon at patreon.com/cinematary. Thank you to our patrons, Cam, Chad Newsom, Christina Daughtry, Harry Eskin, Joe Jordan, Maggie, Ron Hayes, The Kittiest of Kittens, Titus Arthur, Tyler Chandler, and Whitney Rio Ross. Thank you so much for your patronage. Next week, we'll be continuing our World Animation Series with a collection of Yuri Norstein films, which is exciting. He's a very exciting animation director if you're a fan of animation and have not seen his stuff. This is a good opportunity to. So definitely check it out. But until then, thank you guys for listening. We'll see you next week.